So we're looking then at the emotional life of our Lord Jesus Christ. And you may remember that in our introductory session a few weeks ago, I made the point that Jesus' sinlessness, far from restricting his emotions, actually intensified his emotional life. Sin desensitizes us. Sin dulls our emotions. It has a numbing and dulling effect upon us. But Jesus, of course, never knew any sin. He was a morally perfect human being, and so he didn't know that dulling effect that sin has upon his emotional life. And I think at no point is that perhaps more relevant than when we come to the emotion that we're considering this morning, namely Jesus' compassion. What is compassion? Well, compassion is feeling sorry for someone whose situation is adverse and undesirable in some way. Compassion is being touched, it's being moved by somebody else's plight. And it goes without saying then that sin dulls compassion. Because it's the very nature of sin, isn't it, to make us self-absorbed and selfish. Compassion is being oriented toward others and their suffering and their need. Sin orientates us toward ourselves. It turns us in on ourselves. It makes us self-absorbed. And so we then can be driving along the motorway. And we can come upon an accident, a crash that has happened just a little way ahead. And easily the order of our responses can go something like this. First, a frustration, because it's going to cause our journey to be a lot longer than it would have been otherwise. We're going to be delayed. Number two, relief, that we weren't caught up in the accident that's just happened. Number three, resolve. We're going to drive much more carefully from now on, so something like that never happens to us. Number four, fascination. At least it's not just roadworks that's held us up, but it's something a bit more interesting. And then perhaps after all that, fifthly, finally we have a pang of compassion for the people that have been involved in this accident. Easily our order of responses can go something like that, because we are so sinfully self-absorbed. But you see, Jesus had no sinful self-absorption in him. And so his compassion then was more intense and more irrepressible than we can possibly imagine. And of course, being compassionate is a costly business, isn't it? The word compassion then, it comes from Latin, and you know then the word passion. We use that word of Jesus' sufferings. Passion means suffering, and compassion then means to suffer with, to suffer with. So compassion then, in terms of its word origin, is a form of suffering. It's being pained by what's going on in somebody else's life. And so it's costly. We have this term, don't we, in our culture today, compassion fatigue. Compassion fatigue, it's a form of burnout then, which carers and counselors and such like can suffer from. The constant flow of compassion as they are living with, working with needy people, that constant flow of compassion leaves them eventually drained and broken. And in Jesus then, whose compassion, because not diminished by sin, was greater than anybody else's compassion in Jesus, it must have taken a toll. Perhaps that's one reason why in John 8, verse 57, apparently, people thought Jesus was a lot older than he was. They said, "You're not yet 50 years old." Not very flattering words for a man who was in his early 30s. Perhaps he looked a lot older than he actually was. And perhaps one of the reasons for that was just the sheer intensity of this compassion constantly flowing from him. He had compassion fatigue like nobody else ever did. It perhaps left his face gaunt and his hair prematurely grey. And so this is the theme that we're considering this morning, the compassion of Jesus. And I just want to probe it under two very simple headings: the compassion of Jesus on earth and the compassion of Jesus in heaven. So first of all then, the compassion of Jesus on earth. And the compassion of Jesus during his life on earth then, it was directed towards two main categories of people. First of all, it was directed toward the afflicted. It was directed toward the afflicted. I mean, those afflicted then by the various miseries of this life. And that's quite interesting. Because remember, we said last week that Satan is the ruiner of everything. Satan is the ruiner of this once perfect, once pristine creation. If it were not for him, there wouldn't be these miseries in this life. And we saw then that Jesus' mission was to conquer Satan. And he saw then very clearly this connection between Satan and the miseries of this life. And whenever he encountered the miseries of this life, he was angry, we saw. He was angry with the one who ultimately had caused them. He was angry in the face of storms and in the face of fevers and in the face of death. He was angry with Satan. And that then is a very important theme, and I stressed it last week, and it's, I think, a very inspiring and a very rousing theme to witness Jesus, our conqueror, with a healthy dose of anger going toward the cross, there to conquer his and our enemy. It's an important theme. But this is the thing. Yes, in the face of these miseries, Jesus was angry with the one who had caused them, Satan. But at the same time, he was also deeply compassionate toward those afflicted by them. Angry toward the one who had caused them, compassionate toward those afflicted by them. In other words, the anger against Satan in these instances did not so engulf his soul as to leave no room for other emotions. You see it most clearly in that passage we went to last week and have been to on previous weeks, John 11. And there in John 11 we saw very clearly Jesus' anger. Well, I say very clearly, it's not so clear in our English versions, but it's clear in the Greek. In two verses, verse 33 and verse 38, it's clear Jesus was deeply moved, it says in the ESV. He was angered. He was like the snorting horse. He was angered. He was angry with Satan in the face of that death in Bethany. But of course, we know also from John's account that he was moved to tears. He wept, verse 35. And he wasn't weeping there over the loss of his own friend Lazarus. He had lost his friend Lazarus, but he knew what was going to happen. He'd already told his disciples earlier on in the chapter, I'm going to Bethany to wake Lazarus up from his sleep. He knew that Lazarus wasn't going to stay dead. So he wasn't so much weeping out of his own brokenheartedness over Lazarus's death. He was weeping in compassion for Martha and Mary as he saw their brokenheartedness, as he saw the havoc that this had wreaked upon their lives. He just felt for those two women so much. And this ability then of Jesus to harmonize, if that's the right way of putting it, to harmonize two such strong feelings, anger on the one hand, compassion on the other. It's such a beautiful part of Jesus' emotional life, that, isn't it? I mean, you think, again, of a car crash illustration. Change it slightly. Imagine you've seen the car crash actually happen. And you've seen that it was caused by the reckless driving of some particular person. Now, it's difficult, isn't it, in your seething anger in that moment with that driver who has been so stupid and so dangerous and so reckless and has caused this accident, it's difficult in your seething anger to then move into compassion for those who have been affected by the crash. Or another illustration, you watch football fans in the stands at the stadium when one of their players has just been injured by an opposition player who has dived in with a very vicious tackle. And you watch those fans, and the emotion which overwhelmingly predominantly you will see on display in those fans is not compassion for the injured player on the ground, it's anger against the opposition player who has committed the vicious tackle. And that's not because they're callous and don't care about the player who's on the ground. It's just because, again, it's very difficult to move between those two such strong emotions. You're engulfed with either one or the other. But Jesus, he moves between the two there in Bethany. Within a few verses, he's weeping tears of compassion for Martha and Mary, and he's seething with anger against Satan. And it's not then because in his case these emotions were weaker than ours and so it was easier for him to harmonize them. As we've said, his compassion was compassion like nobody else's. And his anger, of course, against Satan was very profound and intense anger. It's just part of the exquisite beauty, I'm saying, of our Lord Jesus Christ, that he could be deeply moved by way of one particular emotion without that being to the exclusion of other emotions. So, the afflicted then, toward whom Jesus had compassion on earth, they included bereaved folk like Martha and Mary, of course the widow of Nain, of whom we read earlier. She's another example of that, isn't she? You know that story and the way in which then this woman's son has died, and it's the day of the funeral, and it just so happens that that same day Jesus and his disciples are passing through the town of Nain, and so it's at the town gate somewhere that their paths cross. And the sight then of that funeral procession, and especially the bereaved mother at the front of it, that affects Jesus very powerfully. He had compassion on her, Luke says, in chapter 7, 13 there, of his gospel. And of course, the striking thing about that incident is that that woman toward whom he had such compassion, she was a complete stranger to him, almost certainly. It's, I suppose, vaguely possible he could have known her, but we don't have any other record of him going to Nain. It was a fairly obscure town. Almost certainly she was a complete stranger. Martha and Mary weren't like that, were they? They were Jesus' close friends. He knows the place that Lazarus has in their lives. He has spent long evenings in that house in Bethany. He's watched the affectionate dynamics between sisters and brother, their gentle teasing of one another, the happy reminiscing of a shared childhood together. He's experienced at first hand the deep and beautiful bond that now has been shattered in death. He has enjoyed those two tear-stained faces in happier times when they were bright faces, smiling and laughing over supper in the house in Bethany. And naturally then, against that backdrop, his compassion flows. But here in Nain, there's none of that backdrop. He doesn't know this woman. Never spent long evenings in her house. He doesn't know what the dynamics were like precisely between her and her son. And you know what it's like. You go to a funeral service at the West Road Crematorium, and it's a busy place with its two chapels and its rigid half-hour time slots, and there are all these different groups of mourners always milling around there. And you arrive, and your sole concern is just to spot some people that you know who are part of the same funeral service that you've come to attend, and you make a beeline for those people, and you barely notice then all the other people at that place. They're just this kind of faceless sea of darkly attired figures. Why? Because they're strangers to you, and so you can't really enter into their situation that day. And here's Jesus, and this funeral procession full of strangers, yet it's not just a faceless sea of darkly attired figures to him. No, they are bereaved, grieving human beings. The woman at the front in particular is a heartbroken mother. And the fact that he's never known them, never been in the house, that doesn't remove the tragic element of this death for Jesus. It doesn't make it somehow manageable and okay. It's a truly marvellous thing, that, isn't it? I'm saying let's admire, as we've been admiring Jesus' love and his anger, let's admire Jesus' compassion. This compassion then that even reached out to complete strangers. But then the afflicted toward whom Jesus had compassion, they weren't just bereaved people, were they? Like Martha and Mary and the widow of Nain. So there are others. There's a leper in Mark 1:41. And as Jesus, just before Jesus heals that man, Mark tells us he was moved with pity. And there are others that we could go to, but we don't have time. But just one other instance that I think is worth noting. And it's those two blind men outside Jericho. We read of them in Matthew 20, verses 29 to 34. And the reason that incident is worth noting is that it highlights the fact that in the Gospels we have two distinct words relating to compassion. So, and that passage highlights the fact because it uses them both. In Matthew 20, we have both these words. So we have the blind men appealing to Jesus for compassion in verses 30 and 31 of Matthew 20. Lord, have mercy on us. Lord, have mercy on us. So there's that word translating ESV, mercy. That's one word we have in the Gospels for compassion. But then we have Matthew in verse 34 reporting Jesus' actual compassion toward them, and it's the word pity in the ESV. Jesus in pity touched their eyes. And so those are the two words that we have throughout the Gospels for compassion. The one there translated mercy and the one translated there pity. And what's interesting is this, that in the Gospels, every time we have somebody appealing to Jesus for compassion, it's that first word, that word translated mercy. So whether it's the mother of a demon-possessed girl, the father of a demon-possessed boy, blind Bartimaeus, 10 lepers, different occasions when people appeal to Jesus for compassion, it's that first word, mercy, just like the two blind men outside Jericho. And then every time we have the writers reporting that Jesus showed compassion, it's always that second word, the word translated pity there in verse 34. So every time Jesus' compassion appealed to, that first word, mercy. Every time Jesus' compassion reported by the evangelists, that second word, pity. What's interesting about that? Well, what's interesting is this. The second word, pity, that we have in verse 34, is a much stronger word than the first word. So that first word, mercy, it refers then to a kind of momentary compassionate impulse. That's what is being appealed for. The second word, pity, it refers to a deep sympathy surging from within the depths of someone's being. It's a long word. Actually, the evangelists seem to have invented it for Jesus. We don't have any record of this word being used anywhere in any other literature than the New Testament Gospels. The evangelists seem to have invented this word because no other word did justice to Jesus' compassion. And the word it has, it's a long word, it has within it the Greek word for bowels. And so you see, here then are these people. And they're kind of approaching Jesus, appealing to Jesus for a momentary, compassionate impulse. But what they actually get from Jesus is so much more. What they get is this kind of bowel-shaking sympathy, this gut-wrenching compassion. That's the picture that we get in the New Testament Gospels. So you think of the beggar sitting in Northumberland Street, and as people walk past, he calls out for help. And what's he hoping for? Well, he's hoping for someone just to kindly throw in a coin or two into his bowl. He's hoping for a momentary compassionate impulse. That's what he's hoping for. Just to throw in a couple of coins as they walk by. He's not hoping for someone to stop and break their heart over his plight. That would be ridiculous. That's just not on his radar. And similarly, these afflicted people in the Gospels, as the renowned miracle worker Jesus Christ walked by, what they hoped for was that they might just get a momentary compassionate impulse. He might just say a word of healing as he walked past. That's what they hoped for. They didn't hope for him to stop and break his heart over their plight. That would be ridiculous. Why would he do that? And yes, that is exactly what he does. In a sense, isn't the experience of those people with regard to Jesus' compassion a microcosm of your experience and my experience with regard to Jesus generally? That what we get from Jesus is so much better than what we ever hoped for. We came to Jesus hoping that he would love us. Love us with a love analogous to the other loves we've known in our lives. And yet what we've received for him is so much better. An infinite, passionate, jealous, all-consuming love. We came to him hoping for forgiveness, just enough forgiveness to get us safely through Judgment Day and safely into heaven. That's what we hope for. What we've received is so much better. Comprehensive eradication of all our guilt and more. He's credited to us his own perfect obedience, so that it's ours in the sight of God. We hope for a bit of character improvement when we came to Jesus. The rough edges smoothed off us, and the vice is tempered a bit, and we've received so much more. We've received this new power to live a new life of a quite different character. It's a wonderful thing about Jesus. You always get so much more than you hope for when you come to him. So Jesus' compassion on earth, it was toward the afflicted. And then secondly, it was toward the Christless. That's what I'm calling them. It was toward the Christless. So Matthew 9:36, famous words. Jesus sees a crowd and he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. What's the significance of that simile? They were like sheep without a shepherd. Well, they didn't have Jesus. That's what it means. Jesus has been set forth from the beginning of Matthew's gospel as a shepherd. In chapter 2, verse 6, Matthew quotes from Micah, a prophecy about Jesus and how he would shepherd his people Israel. So from the beginning, Jesus has been set forth as a shepherd. And when we come to chapter 9, verse 36, and there are these crowds like sheep without a shepherd, it means they are people without Jesus. They don't have Jesus feeding their souls the most soul-satisfying food that there possibly is. They don't have Jesus leading them along the most wisely chosen paths possible. They don't have Jesus protecting them and caring for them and guarding them. And Jesus then feels for them in that state. They don't have him. They haven't believed in him. They haven't put their trust in him. They haven't worshipped him. And he feels for them in that state. That's striking, isn't it? Guess it reminds us that the Bible has more than one perspective from which it regards unbelievers, those who don't have Jesus Christ. Yes, at one level, those who don't believe in Jesus Christ are arrogant rebels, refusing to bow to the King. They are those described in Jesus' parable in Luke 19, verse 14. We will not have this man to reign over us. At one level, that's what your colleagues and your classmates and your neighbors are. They are arrogant rebels refusing to bow to the King, and that's an important perspective. But at another level, those who don't have Jesus are just desperately, desperately needy people. Helpless and harassed in the language of this text. Those who labor and are heavy laden in the language of chapter 11, verse 28. Those having no hope and without God, Ephesians 2, 12. Fitting objects, in other words, of pity and compassion. And that's an important perspective too. And then an even more striking example of this compassion in Jesus is in Luke 19. And in Luke 19 then, Jesus comes to the city Jerusalem. and his compassion toward the city of Jerusalem isn't described in any compassion vocabulary, but it's clearly described because Jesus, verse 41 of Luke 19, weeps. He weeps over the city of Jerusalem. And what's striking there then is that the people in that city are not just Christless, they're not just without him, they're not just unbelievers. They are Christless and they are about to come under God's judgment. He clearly says that, doesn't he? The days will come, verse 43, when your enemies will set up a barricade round you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. They'll not leave one stone on another. Why? Because you did not know the time of your visitation. In other words, you did not recognize me. You did not acknowledge me, the Messiah, the promised one. And because of that, you are about to come under terrible divine judgments. And Jesus then, he isn't protesting that divine judgment. He knows it's right. He knows it's necessary. He's not complaining against God that this city is going to be judged. But nonetheless, he feels for them. He's compassionate toward them. He weeps over them. As Benjamin Warfield says, it hurt Jesus to hand over even hardened sinners to their doom. And you know, there's something terribly faulty in our logic, isn't there? If stormy weather arouses our compassion for the people of Cumbria and Scotland, but not the greater storms of divine judgment for which many of them are heading. If the threat of terrorism arouses our compassion for the people of Paris, but not the greater threats of the terrors of hell under which many of them are living. The direst situation anybody can be in is not floods or terrorist threats. The direst situation anybody can be in is being Christless and heading for God's judgment. And if anything ought to arouse our compassion then, it's surely that. So the compassion of Jesus on earth, it's toward the afflicted and it's toward the Christless. Secondly, and much more briefly, the compassion of Jesus in heaven. And I'm talking then about Jesus now in his exalted, ascended state. Jesus' compassion now. Just a few points quickly. First of all, it's a hidden compassion. It's a hidden compassion. I said in that first introductory session that Jesus' emotions are human emotions, and part of what that means is that they are expressed bodily. So they are expressed through gestures and looks and sighs and tears and that kind of thing. And that then is still the case today, because Jesus is still human and he's still embodied. He still has a body. It's now a glorified body, but it's a physical human body. But of course, the difference is that we cannot see those bodily expressions of Jesus' compassion. They could be seen when he was on earth, and so the gospel writers could record them. Nobody on earth at least, can now see Jesus' compassion. It's hidden. It's because he's in heaven. We're on earth. We can't see that compassion written all over his face when we're afflicted, when we're in difficult situations. And easily then we can disbelieve that compassion. And that's why we need to go often to that text with which we began our service this morning. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. What he was at Bethany, he is today. What he was at Nain, he is today. What he was outside Jericho, he is today. He hasn't changed one bit. The only change is in his visibility. He's now in heaven. We can't see the compassion, but the compassion hasn't changed. The compassion is as strong and as real as intense today toward his afflicted people as it ever was when he was on earth. But I suppose we could probe this further and say that part of the hiddenness of Jesus' compassion is actually something deeper than that. It's this. Jesus, we know, is sovereign. We know that, don't we? That he's the one who controls our lives. He's the one who sends the different circumstances that we face. And often then those circumstances are painful and difficult circumstances. Perhaps some of yours this morning are painful and difficult circumstances. And so Jesus' compassion then, it's hidden often behind the apparent harshness of the way he's governing our lives. How do we deal with that? Well, I suppose it helps to think like this. Actually, there's a degree to which that was true when he was on earth. That then, too, his compassion was hidden often behind an apparent harshness. I mean, you think of Mary and Martha, and the way in which then Jesus' compassion for them, it was very much hidden at the start of that narrative by the way in which he delayed going to Bethany for 2 more days. He receives the message, Lazarus is ill, he stays where he is. If he'd gone straight away, Lazarus wouldn't have died. It would have spared them an awful lot of heartache if he'd just healed Lazarus without him having to die, but Jesus stays where he is 2 more days and Lazarus dies. Or the apparent harshness of Jesus' dealings with Jairus. As, again, Jesus delays, doesn't he? He's on his way to Jairus' house, and again, the daughter's still alive, he could heal her, but then Jesus hangs about. There's this woman who's touched him, and Jesus could just carry on. The woman's been healed, doesn't need to stop, but he does stop, and he talks to her. And that uses up valuable time, and then the message comes, the girl's died. He could have spared Jairus the heartache if he'd just kept on going. Now, how do we deal then with those incidents? Well, we deal with them in this way. On the one hand, we don't deny that Jesus deliberately delayed. He deliberately delayed going to Bethany. He deliberately delayed going as quick as he could have gone to Jairus' house. He wasn't involuntarily detained. This wasn't circumstances out of his control. He deliberately delayed. We affirm that. But then on the other hand, we don't deny either that he felt tremendously compassionate toward all those individuals, toward Martha and Mary. He wept when he got to Bethany. Toward Jairus, he did continue on the journey to Jairus' house. And so we kind of hold these two things in tension. Yes, Jesus deliberately delayed, but he was also tremendously compassionate. And I think that's the tension that we have to hold also when it comes to our situation now. Yes, on the one hand, we must affirm Jesus is the one from whom we receive our painful circumstances. He is sovereign. We don't deny Jesus' sovereignty. That's the route some Christians have gone down. Oh, well, if he's compassionate, he can't be in control. No, we say Jesus is in control. It's from him I get my difficult things as much as my happy things. We affirm that. But at the same time, we affirm he's tremendously compassionate as well. And he weeps for me, and he feels for me, and his heart throbs for me. And we hold both those things. My circumstances are from him, and he's compassionate within those circumstances. The things that are causing my tears are from him, but he weeps with me as I weep. In those circumstances, we hold those two things together in a tension we can't perhaps fully explain, but we know from the Bible to be true. So it's a hidden compassion. Then for another thing, it's a comprehending compassion. It's a comprehending compassion. That's the point of a very well-known text, Hebrews 4:15. You all know it well, I'm sure. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. And by the way, that verse is assuming something interesting. It's assuming that one of the most difficult things we face in this life and for which we most need Jesus' compassion is temptation. Not actually illness and redundancy and financial problems, but temptation. That's one of the hardest things we face, and where more than anywhere we need Jesus' compassion. And the writer's saying you have Jesus' compassion when you're tempted. You have it. He is sympathetic. But more than that, he's sympathetic with a comprehending sympathy, a comprehending compassion. You can be compassionate about someone without really understanding what they're going through. You can be compassionate for famine sufferers in Africa without having the foggiest idea what it's like to suffer in a famine in Africa. But surely a compassion where the one who's compassionate does understand from personal experience, that's a richer kind of compassion, isn't it? And that's the kind of compassion this writer is saying Jesus has. He's saying he feels for you in your temptations and he feels for you as one who has been tempted. Perhaps you need that this morning. You've been tempted powerfully this past week. Tempted to retaliate under severe provocation. Jesus feels for you in that temptation this morning, and he feels for you as somebody who has experienced it himself. Temptation to commit some kind of sexual immorality. Jesus feels for you in that temptation this morning, and he does so as someone who has experienced it himself. Temptation to disbelieve some very fundamental things about the trustworthiness of the Bible, or heaven and hell, or the very existence of God even. Jesus feels for you in that temptation this morning, and he does so as someone who has experienced it himself. Tempted in every respect as we are. What a thing. Comprehending compassion. Thirdly, it's a startling compassion. It's a startling compassion. It's a startling compassion if these words from the Puritan Thomas Goodwin are true. Your very sins move him to pity more than to anger. Your very sins move him to pity more than to anger. Now he said, surely that can't possibly be true. I mean, we said 2 weeks ago with regard to Jesus' love that it's a jealous love. And we saw those Corinthians and they were messing around in the idol temples. And we said that Jesus then, he was jealous. He was jealous about those Corinthians. It was that kind of emotion that their sin aroused in Jesus. Well, surely that's the case with all our sins. It's jealousy it arouses in him, not pity. He's not going to pity us when we sin. I read earlier from Romans 7, didn't I? And isn't there a big distinction between the kind of sinning that's going on in the Corinthians' lives in 1 Corinthians 10 and the kind of sin that Paul is acknowledging in his life in Romans 7? The Corinthians, they're making a lifestyle choice. They are brazenly and unapologetically choosing to retain a bit of paganism in their lives and go and sacrifice in those idol temples. That's not what Paul's doing. Paul's in a different place altogether. He's a holy man. He's a good man. He's a growing Christian man who loves the Lord Jesus passionately, but the flesh is still there within him. And at times he just finds himself suddenly saying something that he shouldn't say, suddenly looking at a woman as he shouldn't look at a woman, suddenly responding to a compliment or a criticism in a way he shouldn't respond to a compliment or a criticism. And he hates the fact that he's doing that. And he says that in my inner being I delight in God's law. And I have the desire to do what is right, he says. And he just can't understand why still he occasionally just erupts in those ways. And he cries out, O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? And that then is a distress that Paul is in there, a misery that Paul is in, that I think Thomas Goodwin has in mind when he says that Jesus pities us in our sins. He's talking about the Romans 7 type of sins, not the 1 Corinthians 10 type of sins. When we're those who, yes, we hate sin, but we still find ourselves doing it. And we just want to be delivered from that. And we say, sin, my worst enemy before, shall vex my eyes and ears no more. We long for that day when my inward foes shall all be slain, nor Satan break my peace again. Jesus feels for us in that misery, that sense of bondage. We want to be free from sin. And that's a precious thing, isn't it? And perhaps a word of comfort for some of us this morning. In our struggles with sin, as conscientious believers, Jesus feels for us. And then lastly, it's a powerful compassion. It's a powerful compassion. I read from Luke 7 this morning, the widow of Nain accounts. There's something strange about it. Luke says Jesus had compassion on her. And then Jesus says something which seems to indicate he has no compassion whatsoever. He says to that woman, "Do not weep." Now, if you read any textbook on counseling, on helping people in their grief, the one thing it will never tell you to do is say to a grieving person, "Don't weep." To be at a funeral and go up to the bereaved person and say, "Don't cry." What insensitivity. What callousness. What harshness. There's only one situation in which you could legitimately do that. And that's if a moment later you're going to go up to the coffin and you're going to say to the person in the coffin, "Get up." And that person gets up. That's the only situation in which you could legitimately say to a griever, "Stop weeping." And that's the situation in Luke 7. It's not lack of compassion. It's powerful compassion that causes him to say those words. Our compassion, so often it's powerless, isn't it? We can be compassionate, but we can't do anything to help the people we're compassionate for. Jesus can. He's compassionate for this woman, and he relieves the situation by raising her son. And Jesus' compassion for us this morning is powerful compassion. He feels for you in your struggles with ill health this morning. And one day he will relieve you and give you a new body that will never be subject to ill health again. As we've just been saying, he feels for you in your struggle with sin this morning. And one day he will put you in a new context where you will never ever sin again. He feels for you in every difficulty, every struggle, every problem, every adversity you're facing in life. And one day he will remove all of those, every single last one of them. Because Jesus' compassion is a powerful compassion that will finally come to fruition in the resurrection of the dead and in the rejuvenation of the universe itself. Amen.